We will go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session Wednesday, June 18, 2014, to consider the matter of Secretary of Labor versus Jim Walter Resources, Inc., docket numbers SE-2008-881 and SE-2008-268-R. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, Commissioner Cohen, Commissioner Nakamura, and Commissioner Alton. We'll start with an overview of the case presented by Sarah Stewart. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. Is my voice loud enough?
I don't know, it's a little soft. Is the little mic on?
Okay. This case arises from an accident that occurred on December 4, 2007 at the Clean Coal Loadout Building at GWR's number 4 mine. At that facility, Clean Coal is moved by a conveyor belt to the top of the bin, where it is dumped and it makes its way into a large metal downward-pointing cone that funnels the coal into trucks parked beneath the cone. The cone surrounds an opening in the floor of a platform, and it is enclosed in a room. JWR contracted with O&O to provide the labor and supervision for a project to replace the cone. O&O was to remove the 8 cone pieces and replace them with new pieces. O&O's work began on the project on December 2nd, 2007. Removal of the cone section exposed the hole in the floor of the platform. During part of the project, the hole was covered with a metal plate that had metal pins taken up on it, which were also referred to in the transcript of the gusset. At some point during the installation of the cone pieces, the metal plate was moved away from covering the entire hole, and a 2x12 board was placed over the open space, partially covering the hole. On December 4th, which is just 2 days after the project began, Tony Pierce, an O&O employee, stood on the board using a pry bar to try to move the fifth cone section into place. The board was dislodged, and Mr. Pierce fell through an opening 25 feet onto a concrete platform. He was not wearing a safety belt or full protection, and he was seriously injured. As a result of MSHA's investigation into the accident, MSHA Inspector Womack issued citations to O&O and JWR alleging violations of 30 CFR Section 77.17.2. Section 77.17.10 provides in part that each employee working in a surface coal mine or in the surface work area of an underground coal mine shall be required to wear protective clothing and devices as indicated below. Paragraph G requires the wearing a safety belt for mine where there is a danger. The Section 104D1 citation issued to O&O alleged an SMS and unwarrantable violation of the standard. The Secretary proposed a $60,000 penalty against O&O, and O&O agreed to pay $5,000 for settlement of the citation. The judge approved the settlement. The citation issued to JWR alleged an SMS.
A little louder. Sure.
Oh, and is my voice too quiet?
I think it was going down.
I'm sorry about that. I'll speak a little louder. The citation issued to JWR alleged an SMS violation of the standard that had been caused by moderate negligence. The citation was terminated on February 5, 2008, after JWR management submitted to MSHA a statement indicating that a greater emphasis on the use of personal protective equipment would be related to contractors doing work at the number 4 mine. And during the process of hazard training, JWR would review recent accidents of contractor employees. The Secretary proposed a $45,000 penalty against JWR. JWR had previously received citations alleging violations of Section 77.17.10G resulting from 2 fatal accidents in which a contractor employee failed to use fall protection. The first accident occurred in 2001 at JWR's number 4 mine, and the second occurred in 2007 at JWR's number 3 mine. Following a hearing on JWR's citation, the judge issued his decision affirming the citation and assessing a civil penalty against JWR $500. rather than the proposed penalty of 45. The judge concluded that O&O violated the standard and that the violation was evident. He reasoned that because the secretary made JWR as the owner-operator for its contracting violation, JWR was liable for the violation. Applying the Section 110I factors instead of the assessment penalty, the judge found that JWR is a large business, that there was no evidence that the proposed penalty would affect the ability to remain in business, and that the violation was either promptly and in good faith. The judge further found that gravity was high and that JWR had a significant history of violations. Regarding negligence, the judge noted that Inspector Womack testified that JWR was moderately negligent because it did not do everything they could to see that its contractor was following federal regulations. The judge found that the closest the secretary had come to providing notice as to the standard of care required at JWR was the abatement required regarding the 2007 incident. Those abatement actions included additional training and requiring JWR to install adequate anchorage, an adequate anchorage system. The judge found that in this instance, JWR had provided an adequate anchorage system and that O&M employees were provided adequate training prior to work weekends. The judge reasoned that the secretary was in essence suggesting that JWR must maintain direct and continuous supervision over its contractor's employees, but that such a requirement is not provided for by law. The judge concluded accordingly that JWR had exercised the standard of care required by law and that the secretary had failed to prove that JWR was negligent. The secretary filed a petition for discretionary review, which the commission granted. On review, the secretary argued that the judge abused his discretion in reducing the penalty against JWR from $45,500. He asserts that the judge failed to explain the reduction adequately, even if the reduction were based on his no negligence finding, because the judge also found history to be significant and gravity to be high. The secretary contends that the judge may not give a positive weight to any one penalty factor. The secretary further contends that in any event, the judge erred in his finding that JWR was not negligent. He asserts that the judge should have applied to JWR the standard of care set forth at 30 CFR section 100.3b, and that JWR failed to meet that standard. The secretary also asserts that the judge failed to consider the two prior fatal accidents in 2007 and 2001. That should have put JWR on notice that it was not meeting its standard of care. More specifically, the secretary argues that the judge erred in excluding proposed government exhibit 13A, which was a citation alleging a violation of section 77.1710G issued to JWR arising from the 2001 accident. The secretary requests that the commission vacate the judge's exclusion of the 2001 citation, the judge's finding of no negligence, and the judge's penalty, and remand for further consideration. In response, JWR argues that the judge properly excluded evidence regarding the two prior accidents, and that substantial evidence supports his finding of no negligence. The operator contends that the judge properly assessed the penalty. It explains that the judge made findings on all six penalty criteria and that a substantial penalty reduction was appropriate based on his findings of negligence alone. Accordingly, JWR requested the commission to affirm the judgment. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah, and I do thank you for all your excellent help in the case. Patiently discussing the record and answering questions with me. Does anybody have any questions at this point, Ms. Hare, before we go into our deliberations? To start us off, to Commissioner Nakamura, is going to begin.
Yes. So a certain amount of deja vu as I thank Sarah again. We were just here thanking Sarah profusely. I do it again. I would affirm the judge's decision in all respects. I believe there's substantial evidence to support the judge's finding that JWR was not negligent. And I don't think the judge failed to consider the 2007 citation incident. He did discuss it. Number two, I don't think there was an abuse of discretion when the judge granted the motion in limine with respect to the 2001 incident. In the alternative, if it could be considered an abuse of discretion, I would find that it was harmless error. And three, I do not believe the judge abused his discretion in reducing the penalty to $500 in this case. He did touch on all the 110I factors, and I think the $45,000 penalty was a special assessment, and I think it was within his discretion to reduce it, and I think it's in line with what a penalty might have been under a regular assessment. Let me first talk about negligence. In Sarah's memo, she cites to the case, quotes the case of A.H. Stone at 5 Femstrick, page 13, which is a 1983 case, where we stated that, quote, each mandatory standard carries with it an accompanying duty of care to avoid violations of the standard, and an operator's failure to meet the appropriate amount of care demanded by the standard can lead to a finding of negligence if a violation of the standard occurs. Here in this case, I believe the secretary struggled to articulate the appropriate amount of care demanded by the operator, Jim Walters, in the context of a violation committed by an employee of an independent contractor. The struggle is reflected in the relatively extensive pretrial litigation that occurred over the discovery and evidentiary issues, including the admission of the 2001 citation, which I'll get to, and in the judge's rulings, if you look at them on the pretrial motions, and in his ultimate decision on the case. For me, to understand the negligence issues, it was helpful to look at an example in the law of torts. For example, a car accident case. In deciding whether a particular driver is negligent, one would first determine what a reasonable driver should have done under similar circumstances. So you would find that a reasonable driver would perhaps use a seatbelt, drive within or close to the speed limit, pay attention to the road, signal when changing lanes. And then you would look at these things in the particular case. No seatbelt, driving, maybe 70 in a 40-mile zone, texting rather than paying attention. So you would have these specific factors to look at in determining whether a driver was reasonable. So in my view, it helped me to look at, well, in this context, what actual actions should Jim Walters have done, or put it another way, what didn't they do that would support a finding that they were negligent? And I think the standard would be what conduct is expected of a reasonable mine operator in the circumstances of hiring an independent contractor to perform this kind of work on this the cone at the loadout facility. And I would probably add something. A reasonable mine operator with knowledge of the goals of the Mine Act. So I think I would first look to see whether the JWR was prudent in hiring the independent contractor, O&O. What does that mean? Well, you don't necessarily pick the lowest bidder. You don't pick your brother-in-law's company. You look at the safety record of the company and decide whether they are a company that does good work and does it in a safe manner. Here, there was no allegation by the secretary, I think, that O&O, the JWR was negligent in the hiring of O&O. In fact, the judge found that O&O was an approved vendor that had worked with Jim Walters on many occasions, and there was no evidence that O&O had been guilty of any safety violations in the past. Secondly, you would want a prudent operator would make sure that the independent contractor was aware and adhered to MSHA safety standards. There's evidence in the record that Robin O'Dell, who was in management of O&O, was an MSHA certified trainer. The record shows that JWR did confirm before the work began that employees had been properly trained. And as the judge pointed out, the secretary did not allege that there was improper training. And I think the record supports that finding, that O&O employees were trained in the use of, in the safety standards, and in particular the use of fall protection. So moving on, once O&O is on the job site, what's Jim Walter's role? Well, probably some sort of monitoring of the job. But this job, the record shows, it was only going to last four or five shifts. So it was going to be a short turnaround. One could see that if a contractor was going to be on the mine site for months at a time, there might be some regular meetings, maybe some re-emphasis of training. This was four or five shifts. And the record does show that the work started with just the cutting of the cone, the old cone, on a Sunday night. Jim Walters was there. I think maybe it was the graveyard shift that they started on.
They did.
Yeah, graveyard shift. So first thing at 7 o'clock Monday morning on the next shift, I think the superintendent of the area of the mine was there to meet with O&O. The evidence shows that at that time he saw that miners who needed to were using fall protection. The work continued on Monday, and then Tuesday an engineer was on the site early and also saw there was a problem. Well, there was O&O thought that a section of the cone came in, new cone came in several sections that had to be put together. There was evidence that O&O, a representative of O&O, thought that the sections might not fit exactly. So an engineer of Jim Walters was brought to the site, and he testified that he saw the use of fall protection at that time. And then it was just a few hours later where the accident occurred. So I don't think, at least so far, that there's any evidence of negligence. Now, what happened here is it's next whether there was some unusual or unexpected condition that might have alerted that JWR should have been alerted to or had knowledge of, that perhaps there was some danger. In the auto accident example, this could be perhaps, was there some object on the road, on the highway, that nobody knew about, that the driver knew or didn't know about, or an ambulance maybe driving through an intersection. If the driver has knowledge of that, maybe even though you're driving within the speed limit, you could be negligent. Here, I guess the unexpected situation occurred when over the hole they had put a metal plate, and there was no allegation that the use of that metal plate was somehow negligent, or allowing O&O to use that metal plate was negligent to cover the hole. The problem was that there were fins on this plate, and for some reason the metal gussets or metal fins on it somehow got in the way of one of the sections of the cone that the ONO had to install. So, as Sarah indicated, somebody moved one of the metal plates out of the way. They were going to, I think it talked about, putting some other flat grate on the hole. But before that happened, Tony Pierce used a piece of 2x12 board to put over the hole, and while he was trying to pry, using a pry bar to, line up the section of the cone that they were working on, I can see, how dangerous that was. He probably put some, pressure on his arms and his feet. Was trying to get leverage probably with his legs and push the board. The board shot out and he fell through the hole. So the issue for the judge here was, what should Jim Walters have done? Or was there something that Jim Walters should have done in this situation? Well, the judge found that Jim Walters had no knowledge of this problem with the moving, of the metal metal piece from the hole, use of the board, and Tony Pierce working on it, and of course in a dangerous manner. The question, and I think what the judge decided was, having no knowledge of it, they couldn't have been negligent. This is where the secretary had trouble articulating what exactly Jim Walters should have done. As the judge noted in his decision, the inspector testified that he had found Jim Walters moderately negligent because it did not do, quote, everything they could, close quote, to see that contractors' employees followed the fall protection standard. So it's not, at least the inspector didn't articulate exactly what they should have done. They just didn't do everything they could. In his post-hearing brief, the secretary was no more specific, arguing they took no interest and no action to determine that O&O Services and its employees and managers were complying with applicable MSHA regulations and with safe practices in this hazardous endeavor. The judge looked at that, considered that argument, and he found that that it was tantamount to arguing that JWR was required to maintain direct and continuous supervision of O&O's employees. And he rejected that argument, saying that's not actions, that's not what a reasonable employee, that's not what a reasonable operator would do, because when you hire a third-party independent contractor, you are turning the job over to them because they have the expertise. And I think the judge is right on that. In the auto accident case, I think JWR is arguing that something like you should do 25 miles an hour and always do 25 miles an hour in a 70 miles hour zone because you don't know when you might encounter a foreign object on the road. But that's not a standard that I think a driver would be held to. I think the secretary, if he was here, would be arguing to me that, oh, except this is different because you could foresee that this hole was there or might be there, and this dangerous condition might be there. But I don't think you could foresee that O&O would remove the plate, that they would put a board over the hole, work on it, and not use fall protection. I think that's you'd have to have a crystal ball, and I don't think that's a standard that we would hold, we should hold operators to in this situation. In his brief to the commission, the secretary tries again and argues that JWR, quote, did not monitor or even inquire about O&O safety practices, thus failing to be on the alert. I don't find this any more specific. So, and I think the judge, of course, was recognized, if you look at the hearing transcript and look at the decision, that the duty of care or the specific things that the secretary was arguing JWR had to do was vague. And so one thing that the judge did was he looked at the specific abatement actions the secretary required of JWR to abate the 2007 citation, which was admitted into evidence. And he said there were two things required: provide additional training, and number two, install adequate anchorage systems to secure personnel from falling, meaning places where O&O's employees could tie off. And if they fell, they would be held in place and not fall to the ground. And the judge found that these things had been already done. And I think there was testimony from, I think, the safety manager of Jim Walters, that those things had already been done. They were things, in fact, that I think he testified that they had been done prior to the 2007 accident. So, and then the judge also noted that this instance citation, that all Jim Walters was required to do was submit to MSHA a statement that greater emphasis of the use of fall protection would be related to contractors, future contractors, and that during hazard training they would review accidents that had happened with respect to contractor employees. So I don't think, based on all of the above, that the secretary was able to prove. First of all, he wasn't able to articulate what Jim Walters should have done exactly, and I don't think that. And of course, because of that, I failed to prove that Jim Walters failed to do something that would support a finding of negligence. And so that's why I would find that the judge's decision was correct in this situation. And let me say that I think the judge, and my discussion of 2001 citation will clear this up. I think the judge did consider the 2007 citation, but in making his ruling, he specifically did with respect to the abatement. But I think he was also saying that citation does not indicate that Jim Walters was necessarily negligent in the previous citation, because what was required of them in the abatement was something actually they had already done. I should mention that I'm not persuaded by the secretary that we should adopt the standard of care set out in 100.3 subsection D. First, I think as Sarah's memo points out, commission judges are not bound by that section. The commission is not bound by that section. Secondly, I'm not sure that the standard set out in there is really any different than a reasonable operator standard. It does talk about a high degree of care, but I'm not advocating here, and I don't think anybody's advocating that we use just a reasonable person standard. I mean, a doctor would be held to a higher standard of care than, say, a Good Samaritan. And I think using a reasonable mine operator, reasonably prudent mine operator, knowing the goals of the Mine Act, does require a high standard of care. Third, that wasn't the problem here. I think the problem wasn't the standard. It was that the Secretary couldn't articulate exactly what actions Jim Walters should have taken or did not take. Let me move on to the denial of admission of the 2001 citation. As I indicated, I do not believe the judge's grant of the motion in limine with respect to the 2001 citation was an abuse of discretion. And even if it was, I believe it was harmless error. When I first read the judge's ruling, and it was done orally at the hearing with respect to the 2000 documents relating to the 2001 incident, I wasn't sure exactly what he was talking about. He said, "I understand from the Secretary's representation," this is a quote from page 10 of the transcript, "I understand from the Secretary's representation that she wanted this evidence on the issue of negligence to show," that meaning the 2001 documents, "to show on the issue of negligence, to show that Jim Walters had notice of the Secretary's position with respect to liability for violations committed by this independent contractor." Then he says, "I feel, however, that this incident was too old, or is too old, to represent an expression of the unreviewable prosecutorial position in late 2007. And, you know, my first reaction was, "What does that mean? What's he talking about?" He acknowledges that it's being submitted on the issue of negligence, but then he says, "I'm not letting it in because it's not an expression of the prosecutorial position of the Secretary in 2007. So I, you know, did what you have to do, look at the record, the whole record. And in looking at the record, I think it's clear that what the judge was saying here is that on the issue of negligence, the standard of care demanded of the operator in these independent contractor cases is so vague. It's been so vague. And I guess Jim Walters was arguing so arbitrary. That the fact that JWR was cited for a fall protection incident in 2001 provides little, if no proof, that it had notice of what conduct was expected of it in 2007. And if you read further in the transcript, and you know, I give the judge some leeway here as to what he said, because he's doing this orally on in court. If you look further in on page 17, the judge says, "I understand, and apparently there is no dispute that an operator can be charged with the violation." So he's not saying that you can't be charged. The question, I guess, goes, I should have said more specifically with respect to notice and negligence. So when he's talking about this 2001, denying this 2001 incident, that's what he means. He's talking about notice and negligence. And again, on page 20, he says, "not liability, but for negligence, the issue of negligence. I'm not concerned with liability. I think it's clear that the operator can be liable, but the question of level of negligence is the primary issue I'm concerned about." So I think when he denies the 2001 documents that the Secretary was trying to provide, he was basically saying it doesn't provide any notice of negligence on the part of Jim Walters, because the standards are vague there and vague here. And I should mention that with respect to the 2001 incident, there is a reported case involving the independent contractors involved there, Sedgman and PIW. And a footnote in that case is reported, so you know, I think I can consider this. A footnote in that case indicates that in 2001, JWR was cited, but assessed a penalty in the neighborhood of $1,000. So and I've been settled for less. That makes me, I guess, confident that, negligence was not shown or asserted in that case, and that it wouldn't have been error not to use that as some benchmark that Jim Walters had notice of that it had to meet. The other thing about this is that it was actually a whole package of documents and not just the citation that the secretary was trying to get admitted. It was the citations against the two contractors, the settlement, and then the MSHA investigation report. And Jim Walters, in the motion in limine, was trying to knock all of that out. And I think the judge was faced with all that and made his decision. They were enumerated separately, and he made his decision separately. But I think he was looking at that whole package of documents, and I think he thought that wasn't something that was going to show negligence on Jim Walters' part. I know on appeal the secretary, for strategic reasons, only is arguing that the citation itself should have come in. But given what I've just said, I don't think it was an abuse of discretion to grant the motion in limine. And also, given what I said earlier with respect to negligence, if I, 2020 hindsight, I probably would have let the citation in. And then, most judges I know, administrative law judges, always let the document in and say, well, I'll weigh it. And you could maybe, in light of all that, give it a little weight. But in light of what I said, even if it was an abuse of discretion, I believe it was harmless. That leads me to the reduction of the penalty. Penalty proposed was $45,000. The judge imposed $500. My first reaction was, boy, that's a pretty big reduction. Is that warranted here? The judge did consider all the 110I criteria, so we did do that. I touched all the bases. But the secretary had used the special assessment process, and that's discretionary on the part of the secretary. I don't think the commission is bound by that decision, and just as it's not bound by the penalty assessed. I know other commissioners engaged in a calculation of our own. If this had been a regular assessment, under the point system with no negligence, I calculated a penalty of $651 without the 10% reduction. I couldn't determine whether this particular injury was permanently disabling or just a lost days. I think that it was the box was checked by the inspector at the time that it was permanently disabling. I know that Mr. Pierce suffered some broken bones and maybe some internal injuries. But even then, it would be $971. So $500 is in the ballpark. If it were a special assessment, no negligence, roughly maybe it'd be a $10,000 penalty. But again, should this have been a special assessment? Well, based on just gravity, I think there's some indication by the solicitors. The solicitor was asked at the hearing, when do you bring these cases against the mine operator for third-party violations by third-party contractors? And they said, we don't bring them in all situations, but if the gravity is great. So I suppose you could, based on gravity alone, perhaps, impose a special assessment. But again, I think that's discretionary here. Perhaps I didn't see that the secretary specifically argued that. In any event, I think that the $500 is not out of the universe, given that there's no negligence found, especially if you use the regular assessment. So I find that at least in this case, it was no abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner McNamara. Next, we'll hear from Commissioner Hoffman.
Thank you, Chairman Jordan. And thank you, Commissioner McNamara, for that wonderful recitation of the facts and your reasoning. I agree with you on everything you said, so much so that I probably shouldn't say anything. But I am a lawyer, and it's the only chance I get to talk to all four of you at one time about the case. So I have to go ahead, even though there's no hourly rate applying here today. With respect to negligence, I think there is substantial evidence to support the judge's finding of no negligence. And in comparing it, first let me say what the secretary apparently asked for at the hearing, that they didn't do everything they could. That's not a standard as far as I can see. There's no standard to everything they could. I don't know how you'd ever apply such a standard. I don't think we have to set a standard of care in this case. If we did, I think the one Commissioner Nakamura outlined would be appropriate. I do have to burden you by reading what I think is the key paragraph in the judge's decision with respect to why he found no negligence, because I think it sort of sets off his reasoning versus the standard of care of the secretary would urge upon us. He said, in this case, an anchorage system had indeed been provided by way of loops welded into the cones. The record also shows that before work began, JWR confirmed that the O&O employees had received all of the requisite training for the job. Indeed, the secretary has not alleged that the O&O employees were not provided adequate training. In addition, the record shows that when JWR personnel were present, they observed fall protection in use. Key. Furthermore, there is no evidence that any JWR personnel were aware that Pierce was working over the open hole or that Pierce failed to wear fall protection. Finally, the record shows that O&O was an approved vendor with whom JWR had years of prior safe work experience, that it had never been cited for a violation of MSHA regulations, that it had safety training program, and that it had provided the necessary safety harness and anchorages for Mr. Pierce. Now, the secretary says that the judge in that finding essentially doesn't apply the right standard of care, and says we should apply, the judge should have applied the standard in 100.3D, which is the high standard of care, and then sort of more specifically on the table where it talks about negligence, for no negligence, the standard for no negligence set out in the regulation on the table on the next page is, quote, the operator exercised diligence and could not have been aware of the violative condition or practice, close quote. Now, I think if we put that together with what I would perceive as the key sentence in the judge's finding, there is no evidence that any JWR personnel were aware that Pierce was working. I think what the secretary's arguing somehow is that they could have been aware, and if they could have been aware, they had to be aware. And if they could have been aware and were not aware, then they're negligent. But I don't think you can read even the secretary's standard, which is not mandatory, not binding upon us, and we have de novo penalty rights, of course. But even reading that sentence, the operator exercised diligence and could not have been aware of the violative condition or practice, can't be read literally that an operator has to always know what's going on at every site on the job. I mean, as the judge here said, it would mean the only way they would have been known that they'd taken off the metal grate and replaced it with a board and Pierce did this and didn't use fall protection filters if they had a person specifically designated to stand there and watch the operation the entire day. And that's not the standard we apply even to operators with respect to fall protection. We'll even, our ALJs will vacate a fall protection violation by an operator if the operator can show that they provided the fall protection, that they provided the training for the fall protection, and that they had a disciplinary program so that they made it very abundantly clear to minors that they have to use the fall protection. Under those circumstances, even an operator's minor fall, who just on his or her own neglected to use the fall protection, will be vacated by us. So we don't apply this standard to be a absolute obligation to know. I think probably if this were going to be the standard, reasonably would have to be inserted somewhere. So I don't think this can be, I think it would have to be read to mean the operator exercised due diligence and could not reasonably have been aware of the violative condition or practice, because otherwise it would mean stationing people around to watch everything that happens, even at their own minors. I mean, you could always know a minor wasn't using fall protection if you required it every time a minor needed to perform an action that required fall protection, somebody else was assigned to go out there and make sure he or she had the fall protection on. And that's not our standard. And actually, I don't think it's reasonably what MSHA means by this standard. And here we're talking about not the miners and not the operator's employee, but a contractor employee. So given the entirety of the no negligence paragraph and all of the evidence that Judge Nakamura so eloquently laid out for us, I think a final sentence is actually implicit in the judge's finding, which is, I think this is equivalent to a finding that JWR exercised due diligence and reasonably could not have been aware of the violative condition or practice. So even were we to apply the standard MSHA wants us to apply, this decision is based upon substantial evidence. Because, as I say, I think the judge is right. You can only know if you've stationed somebody there to watch. I also agree with Commissioner Nakamura that it's harmless error to have kept out that 2001 citation. This is a trial by a judge. Had he let it in, there's no indication. It probably is. Many administrative law judges will let anything in, and I'll let it in for what it's worth. And had he done that, there'd be no dispute here, and he still would have just ignored it because he didn't think it was relevant. So I see that as harmless error. And for that reason and the reasons laid out by Commissioner Nakamura. Now, the penalty part of this sort of interests me even more than the negligence part of it. The Secretary objects to the reduction of the penalty from $45,000 to $500, claiming the change is arbitrary and capricious, abuse of discretion. Of course, here, if the Secretary had assessed the penalty under the regular point schedule with moderate negligence, the assessed penalty would have been depending upon severity, it would have been somewhere between $2,900 and $3,500. Now, orderly criteria laid out in the Secretary's regulations on regular penalty assessments, I think are vital to the Mine Act's proper enforcement because they allow for a non-arbitrary, orderly enforcement in which operators, MSHA, and indeed the public and the miners are aware generally of what penalties will be assessed depending upon the six criteria. One of the most important jobs we have as a commission, it seems to be, is to guard against arbitrariness in the assessment of penalties. Now, that's one of the reasons, one of the important reasons Congress created this, because they found that certain arbitrariness had crept into the, not the necessarily assessment, but the collection of penalties. So where can the penalty situation become arbitrary? Well, of course, as Congress noted, it can be arbitrary in settlements. So they were concerned that MSHA might, just for reasons unknown to anyone but MSHA, drop penalties from an assessed penalty of $10,000 to $50 and settle the case. So one of the important jobs of our administrative law judges and us is to look at settlements and approve them and make sure a change in penalty incident to a settlement is not arbitrary, that there is a reason for the change in penalty. A second way arbitrariness can creep into the system, of course, is very rarely, but I dare say sometimes, one of our administrative law judges might seem to be arbitrary. They assess penalties de novo, but that does not mean doing what they think is right or applying it in whatever reason they would. They are not Judge Roy Bean Law west of the Pecos in setting penalties. And for that reason, we've said in Spartan Mining, quote, when it is determined that penalties are appropriate which substantially diverge from those originally proposed, it behooves the Commission and its judges to provide a sufficient explanation of the basis underlying the penalties assessed by the Commission. In Cantera Green, the Commission clarified that while the findings and explanations relating to a penalty assessment do not have to be exhaustive, they must at least provide the Commission with a basis for determining whether the judge complied with the requirement to consider and make findings concerning the Section 110 penalty criteria. close quote. I think that's an excellent case, an excellent decision by us as a guard against arbitrary decisions by our ALJs. And if an ALJ, for example, issues a decision with all the same findings that the Secretary made in assessing the penalty, I would suspect that any substantial divergence, now there will be divergences because as we all know, there's the penalty criteria are specific and they jump from 5 to 10 to 15, and a judge may look at a continuum of negligence and fall in between these arbitrary jumps. So there will be changes. But if it is more, if the judge finds all the same criteria as a basic assessment and goes makes a substantial change, which I would consider to be something more than, pick your number, 10, 15, 20%, 20% on the outside of a substantial change. If they're going to change a penalty by more than 20%, let's say, when they found all the same criteria as the judge is assessed on, they have to give a very good explanation to us, to avoid arbitrariness, as to which of the factors have caused them to make that substantial deviation, because we have to guard carefully against arbitrariness in the decisions. Having said that, there's a third area in which arbitrariness, it seems to me, can readily creep into the system, and that, of course, is what we face here, special assessments. Here, the Secretary decided to specially assess the penalty at $45,000, which is somewhere between a 1,200 or to 1,500% increase. So it's kind of odd. The Secretary saying, by God, how could you go from 45,000 to 500, where actually they went from 3,000 to 45,000? You know, but did they explain that to us or to the judge? Absolutely not. They provide no explanation as to why the special assessment was made or what factors caused them to make that special assessment. We do know that when they make a special assessment, the figure is derived from arbitrarily adding points to the negligence and gravity criteria, and then in a completely discretionary manner, they can vary that by 25% up or down. However, in reality, to an ALJ, is completely arbitrary number. Yet the Secretary now says the ALJ erred in diverging from it. I think in the appropriate case, we should add a corollary to this part. That, and this is my quote, in the appropriate case, not necessarily this case. Quote, when the Secretary determines the penalties are appropriate which substantially diverge from the regular penalty schedule, i.e. special assessment, it behooves the Secretary to provide a sufficient explanation of the basis for the specially assessed penalties. While the explanations need not be exhausted, they should provide the Commission with a basis for determining that the specially assessed penalty was rationally based upon the Section 110I criteria. I guess this is, in the old saying, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If we impose this on our ALJs, and I'm sure MJ is very much in favor of that, why does an MJ in its special assessment process give us some basis to understand why they would raise the penalties so drastically? I can speculate here, and we could all speculate, and we'd probably come up with 3.5 different speculations. So if MJ does not provide such an explanation, I think the ALJ is on his or her own in accordance with the penalty criteria. If you get a special assessment of $45,000 when the regular assessment would have been $3,000, I think all bets are off in terms of diverging from that special assessment penalty, and the ALJ is now on his or her own to make a judgment based upon the penalty criteria and doesn't have to explain to me why it's not $45,000, does have to explain to me why it's whatever they decide upon in light of the penalty criteria. Here the judge discussed all of the penalty criteria, but I again agree with Commissioner Nakamura that the no negligence finding was, of course, decisive in his penalty, and had to be decisive among the six. He gave more weight to no negligence. Under the regular criteria, even if he just used the regular criteria and reduced moderate negligence to no negligence, it would have been zero negligence points, and the regular penalty would have fallen to somewhere like $600 with good faith for abatement. So under the regular criteria, not knowing why this should be specially assessed, particularly in light of his findings are supported by substantial evidence, he imposed a penalty clearly within the scope of a regular penalty under those criteria. Therefore, while I personally might have gone higher, I can't find $500 to be an abuse of discretion. And for those reasons, and those stated more, better stated by Commissioner Nakamura, I would affirm his decision.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Alvin. Commissioner Cohen?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I also want to thank Sarah for the excellent memo that she did and for consultations with me and allowing me to pick her brain from time to time here. I agree in part with what Commissioners Alvin and Nakamura have said, and I think I disagree in part with them. As to the allegation that the judge failed to explain the reduction, this is the part that I agree with them. It's a very steep reduction from $45,000 to $500,000, and our case law does require that a judge making this type of reduction must provide an adequate explanation. But assuming that the judge's findings on negligence were without error, I agree with my colleagues that the judge's explanation for the $500 penalty was adequate. The judge clearly identified his findings as to each of the six Section 110I factors. In discussing the penalty, the judge spoke at length about negligence, and it's clear that the reduction of the penalty to $500 resulted from the judge's analysis of the negligence issue. I think it would have been preferable if the judge had performed an explicit weighing of the factors, but I don't think that's required in our case law. If we can discern the pathway that the judge followed in making his ultimate conclusion, then I think that's sufficient, and I think that the pathway is discernible here. Citing the Fort Scott fertilizer case, the Secretary argues that the judge erred in giving dispositive weight to a single factor. But Fort Scott fertilizer does not stand for that proposition. It was a case where the judge explicitly considered only one factor. Here, in contrast, Judge Mellick considered all of the factors and then chose to rely on the factor of negligence. The Commission has held in cases such as Spartan Mining and Musser Engineering that a judge does not abuse his discretion in relying on two of the factors to significantly increase the proposed penalty. Similarly, it would not be error for a judge to rely on a single factor such as negligence to significantly reduce the penalty. Now, the Secretary also suggests in his brief that the correct standard, that the correct model for weighing the factors is set out in the Part 100 regulations on penalties, and states that in this formula, the factor of gravity is given the most weight, and negligence would generally account for less than half of the total penalty. The Secretary's brief recognizes in a footnote that the Commission has held that the Part 100 penalty formula is not binding on the Commission and its ALJs. However, I note that the Secretary seeks to propose a rule that would make the Part 100 formula binding on Commission judges. And since the Commission can only speak through its decisions, I think it is important that our decision in this case explicitly reject the Secretary's suggestion here that judges have to follow the Part 100 formula. I think it's all well and good that the Secretary should have this formula applied to the Office of Assessments in proposing penalties where they are looking at thousands of citations that MSHA issues in any given year. Standardization in that setting is desirable, but Commission judges consider the particular facts of each case. To a judge, one or two of the Section 110I factors could well be more significant in a particular setting than all of the others. Under the split enforcement scheme created by Congress, it is the judge's prerogative to give such weight to the factors as he deems appropriate, as long as the judge does not abuse his discretion. inevitably, since judges are human beings, this will create less standardization in terms of the factors having the same relative weight. But at the same time, standardization of the weight of the factors can lead to arbitrariness in the setting of the penalties. We witnessed this in the application of the federal criminal sentencing guidelines, to use another kind of analogy. Here, having individual experienced judges make determinations of the relative weight given to factors on a case-by-case basis will lessen arbitrariness and increase fairness. In creating the system, Congress opted for individual case-by-case decision-making over the standardization that the Secretary seeks. The Commission should not be reluctant to forthrightly support this choice and say so in the decision in this case. I would also note that the Secretary settled the proposed penalty of $60,000 against O&O Services in this case for $5,000. The negligence of O&O Services in creating the serious injuries to the minor was far greater than any negligence on the part of JWR. I find it difficult to understand the Secretary's complaint about the judge's significant reduction of the penalty to JWR when the Secretary agreed to a very significant reduction of the O&O Services penalty. I hadn't given any thought to the point that Commissioner Althon made just now about the effect of the special assessments and his suggestion that we should somehow suggest or require that the Secretary give some explanation. I don't think we should for a couple of reasons, and this is just off the top of my head.
No, good.
One is that I don't think we should make a suggestion that the Secretary is going to totally ignore.
That's the rule I apply with my wife, so I guess it's probably good for the Secretary, too.
But the second is that if we do this, if we put something like that in, then we would, in effect, be recognizing the validity of the formula as applied to our decision-making. And I don't think we should do that.
That's a fair point.
No, we shouldn't give it that much credibility. If the Secretary, it's their job to propose penalties. If they want to propose them by formula, generally, okay. And if they want to deviate in certain circumstances, okay. And because of their unreviewable prosecutorial discretion, they're not going to account for why they made the change.
I agree.
Can't do anything about it.
I agree with that. The only thing that gets me a little bit is when they come in and argue, this is a 92% or 99% reduction in our penalty, when their penalty just comes out of nowhere. You know, I mean,
well, I
then they shouldn't make that argument. You know, they shouldn't make that argument. But
well,
but they'll ignore that too. I understand.
Yeah. Turning now to the negligence side of it, I find myself in fundamental agreement with the Secretary on this side of the case. We have to recognize that the reduction of the penalty to $500 is based on the finding that there was no negligence whatsoever on the part of JWR. If this finding rests on a questionable basis, then so does the penalty assessment. It's not like we're looking at a group of reasons that may support a judge's conclusion on something like unwarrantable failure, where we might find that even without the questioned basis, the other bases are strong enough to support the conclusion. We did that in a case, and I can't remember the name of the case offhand, but I know we've done that recently. But here everything rests on the finding of no negligence. I question that finding for at least two reasons. One reason involves the scope of what the judge was looking at, and the other reason involves the lens through which the judge did his looking, i.e. the standard of care. Taken together, I think that these reasons pretty much preclude a determination of harmless error, but instead require a remand. First, going to the scope of what the judge looked at, the judge failed to consider two incidents in which employees of contractors for JWR were killed after falling when they failed to tie off in violation of 77 CFR section 1710G, which is the same regulation as is involved here. As the Secretary alleged, these incidents are relevant to JWR's negligence in that they provide evidence that JWR knew or should have known that it was failing to meet its standard of care with regard to contractors' safety practices, particularly with regard to 77 CFR section 1710G. The first of the incidents was in 2001. Here the judge excluded Government Exhibit 13A, which was evidence of the violation in the form of the citation issued to JWR, finding that this evidence was, quote, too old. I think that the judge misapprehended the Secretary's purpose in offering evidence of the 2001 incident, saying that it went to the question of prosecutorial discretion in MSHA's citing of an owner-operator for a contractor's violation. Additionally, I think it was an abuse of the judge's discretion to conclude that a very similar violation of the same regulation was too old because it occurred 6 years before the citation or the violation in question. I don't know when evidence of a mine fatality becomes too old, but I don't think that 6 years is sufficient. I disagree with JWR's contention that the exclusion of this evidence was governed by the law of the case doctrine. And I also disagree with JWR's reliance on Rule 404 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. Although I had considerable difficulty in understanding that rule when I was in private practice, in this case, I think it's pretty clear that the Secretary was not seeking to admit the 2001 citation as evidence of character, but rather to prove knowledge, which is a permissible use under Rule 404B2, and it's a matter very relevant to the issue of negligence. The second incident occurred in July 2007, less than 5 months before the fall, which gave rise to the citation in this case. The judge did permit the introduction of the July 2007 citation in evidence, but then he failed to properly consider its relevance. He considered that citation, or at least discussed it, only with regard to MSHA's requirements for abatement. He did not indicate any consideration of whether the July 2007 incident represented evidence that JWR knew or should have known that it was not properly directing its contractors with regard to the safety procedures required by 77 CFR section 7710G. In addition to the failure to consider evidence of the two prior fatalities involving contractors, I believe that the judge also erred in his discussion of the standard of care and whether the Secretary provided notice of the standard of care to JWR. In this regard, the judge quoted Inspector Womack's statement that JWR failed to do everything they could. Obviously, and I agree with my colleagues, that's too broad. The judge also looked at the specific steps which MSHA required for abatement of the citation and the earlier 2007 citation issued to JWR. Steps taken to abate a violation are not the same thing as the standard of care and should not be used as a surrogate for the standard of care. The standard of care applied by the judge was, in my view, too low. I agree with the Secretary that an appropriate standard of care, an appropriate standard of care, is contained in 100 CFR Section 3D, which states, quote, under the Mine Act, an operator is held to a high standard of care. A mine operator is required to be on the alert for conditions and practices in the mine that affect safety or health of miners and to take steps necessary to correct or prevent hazardous conditions or practices. I think that's a workable standard which judges can apply in determining whether an operator breached the standard of care. It does not require the operator to do everything it can, paraphrase Inspector Womack, but rather to be on the alert and to take appropriate steps to ensure safe practices. it's applicable to situations involving employees of contractors as well as the operator's own employees. Now, I recognize that the standard is contained in Part 100, which is not binding on the Commission, but I don't think that there's any inconsistency in saying that this is an appropriate standard, where at the same time we say we reject the application of the formula in the way that MSHA wants us to apply. The fact that the standard appears in Part 100 does not mean that, if it makes sense, it should not be adopted by the Commission. Now, I recognize that the Secretary did not articulate this or any other standard of care when the case was before the judge. The standard of care was not articulated by the Secretary until this appeal. Moreover, I don't think that the Commission has articulated the standard of care owed by an owner-operator to the employees of a contractor. So one can understand why the judge was floundering in attempting to describe the standard of care. But the standard of care is a legal issue. It is not something we consider in terms of substantial evidence. If the standard of care applied by the judge was incorrect, then we should correct it, no matter how much we may sympathize with the judge in the position that he was given the material that he was given. The Secretary also argues that the evidence demonstrates negligence on the part of JWR because JWR did not monitor or even inquire into the safety practices of O&O services. The Secretary alleged that JWR has a, quote, see no evil, unquote, policy under which its responsibility for the safety of contractors' employees ends when the contractor's work begins. I don't think that that's an accurate characterization of what JWR did in this case, but I am troubled by the testimony from Jim Walter Management that it has no responsibility for the safety of a contractor's employees. At this point, I'm not sure whether JWR's policies in monitoring contractors rise to the level of negligence. I do find it especially disturbing that the safety director testified that he did not receive any direction from JWR's upper management regarding his responsibility to determine whether contractors such as O&O services were complying with MSHA standards. I think I'm personally influenced by the fact that years ago I was hired by the state of West Virginia to investigate the explosion of the Blacksville No. 1 mine, and it was a situation where Consolidation Coal had employed a contractor to install a dewatering pipe when it was in the process of closing this mine, and there was an explosion within the shaft, which killed four miners and severely injured two other miners, including both Consol employees and the contractor's employees. And I was disturbed by Consol's attitude in seeking to essentially wash its hands of responsibility for contractor safety. I'm not sure to what extent that applies here. So, as I was saying, I'm still considering that part of the case, and it may be related to the fact of the two fatal accidents involving JWR contractors for violations of 77 CFR 1710G. Commissioner Nakamura and Commissioner Althon have concluded that any errors by the judge in this case were harmless. I think we have to be very careful in applying the harmless error doctrine. By applying it, we take fact-finding away from the judges. We also risk the appearance of arbitrariness ourselves in saying that there is no view of the evidence which could conceivably lead to a finding of any negligence at all on the part of JWR. I think that's a difficult thing to do, especially where I believe that the judge applied the wrong standard of care, and no judge has applied the correct standard of care in this case and considered the two prior fatalities. So for those reasons, I'm reluctant to apply a harmless error kind of approach to the case. I recognize that there are strong points to be made in support of the result reached by the judge, made by Commissioner Nakamura and Commissioner Alton. Nevertheless, I, at least at this point, and you know, I'm open to further discussion, but I think it would be better to remand the case.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Cohen. Next, Commissioner Young.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I'd also like to thank Sarah for the excellent memo, which I generally agree with. I agree with my three colleagues on the penalty issue. In particular, if it becomes the majority opinion, I agree with the way Commissioner Cohen expressed it to a point. I think that there is already an appropriate commission standard of care, and that's the reasonable person standard, which should have been applied in this case. On the negligence issue, I agree with Commissioner Cohen and his analysis and assessment of that issue. And I think that if we applied the reasonable person standard in this case, it would require us to take into account the 2001 and 2007 fatalities involving JWR contractor employees falling to their deaths. As the Secretary correctly points out, 7 years or 6 years is not too long for a mine fatality to have faded from memory. And as Commissioner Cohen reminds us, we ought to bear those things in the foreground. When it happens one time, it's a signal event for an operator. I can't believe I'm saying this, it seems so obvious, but a mine fatality of one of your operations as an operator is a big, big deal. It's a real big deal. And when you have a second one occur that's similar, violating the same standard involving contractor employees, that's not just another data point. That seems to be indication of a possible trend. The third one, you know, this gentleman is lucky to be alive. When you look at the situation here, I agree with Commissioner Nakamura, there's a lot of fumbling around and trying to articulate what JWR might have done, but before us at least, I think there's some clarity in what the Secretary had to say when he talked about Mr. Osborne, the project supervisor, and his discussions with O&O and its plans and operations on these cones. When you're working at height, the operative context has to include those two fatal falls. That has to be in your foreground as an operator, and you have to relate that to your management and supervisory personnel so that they can keep it in the foreground of the people that you hire to work at your mine. All it might have taken in this case, all it might have taken is for Mr. Osborne to have checked to make sure that the steps that JWR took, including providing the lugs for tying off fall protection and the training, were in the foreground of the contract operator in this case. That was not done. I would agree with Commissioner Cohen. The issue should be remanded and properly reanalyzed. I would not hold JWR to be per se negligent in this case. But at the same time, I think it's important that the negligence analysis undertaken on remand take into account these two prior incidents. As to the relative negligence in this case, in 2004 we had a case, a 20-mile case, where the Secretary chose to charge 20-mile for some contractor violations. And honestly, I believed at the time, and I still believe it was nonsense. We got spanked pretty hard by the D.C. Circuit that essentially told us, look, this is unreviewable. Once they decide to cite the owner-operator or the contractor or both, that's the Secretary's decision. And I've been waiting a long time for a case to come up where we could say, well, you can cite all you want, but you got to prove something. I'm going to keep waiting. I don't believe that this is necessarily that case, where the relative negligence is so stark that that you could say that JWR absolutely, as a matter of law or as a matter of the record before us, was not negligent. I think that you have to look at it more carefully, applying the other factors. It bothers me greatly that the Secretary reduced O&O's penalty as much as it did. I don't know how this happens. I would kind of disagree with Commissioner Nakamura a little bit about the hole being a problem. I don't think the hole is a problem. The lack of fall protection is a problem. That's the issue here. That's what they're required to do. You don't know what might go wrong in a mine site, but you do know that things go wrong because people get complacent, because they take shortcuts, and that's what happened here. Definitely, there's a shortcut in play that created the hazard with this hole and the board that was just kind of kludged on there. But JWR perhaps got complacent, feeling that by selecting a good contractor in its mind, somebody experienced, that it had absolved itself of the responsibility. You don't ever absolve yourself of the responsibility to make sure that safety is an active process. You cannot have a checklist mentality in matters of life and death. And I think that that's something that that we need to know. Here in this case, I don't know how the Secretary, what factors were taken into account. We talk about arbitrary penalties and reducing the penalty for O&O. They had a supervisor standing on top of this process. The guy not wearing fall protection, standing on a board over a hole 25 feet down to a concrete pad. If you've ever stood on the edge of something 25 feet up, it's a long way down. It's a long way down looking at water. Forget about concrete. And there's a supervisor standing right there. So, you know, there are issues here about the relative negligence and how this case was managed. But as to whether there is an appropriate path for taking into account those prior incidents and fully analyzing not whether JWR, quote, did everything that they could do, unquote, but whether they took the steps that a reasonable mine operator familiar with the protective purpose of the safety standard and with knowledge that two contractors had failed to ensure that the fall protection measures had been taken at its facilities in the past, took the appropriate measures and exercised due diligence in this context. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Young. I really appreciate all the analysis and discussion that my colleagues have presented here. I think that in the end, though, I am in favor of affirming the judge's decision. I think that Commissioner Nakamura's analysis is appropriate, that in looking at, the question is whether the judge's finding of no negligence, the initial question, was supported by substantial evidence. And in my case, the question of the proper standard we've discussed here today, it seems almost like a little bit of, you know, a Goldilocks discussion. Well, you know, the Secretary has said they didn't do all they could do. I mean, that I agree. That is just so broad. I wouldn't know as an operator exactly what really what I should do to fulfill my duty. The maybe looking specifically at what they had to do to correct their prior violations is, yeah, that's not just held to that. That's too narrow. What is the correct standard? I don't know if I'm opposed to the standard that the Secretary has proposed here in Part 100, but my problem is I don't see where that would make any difference, even if that standard were applied, because the Secretary has said, and the way that standard reads, I mean, you could say it should be a reasonable operator. You could say, as the Secretary argues, it should say that an operator is held to a high standard of care. But that kind of elaborates. The mine operator is required to be on the alert for conditions and practices in the mine that affect the safety and health of the miners. And I think, as Commissioner Nakamura very thoroughly pointed out, there's
nothing the Secretary has presented to me that shows me, you know, that they didn't feel they were not on the alert. Now, could I sit and speculate about what I might do? I mean, surely this case, you do take up this case, and, you know, reaction, I understand totally Commissioner Young's feeling on this, and I have wrestled with this too. I was just like, how can this be? This operator had two prior incidents, and they had another fall accident, and that's winding up being assessed a $500 penalty. It's just like, wait, something's wrong here. But still, upon careful reflection, I have to say, well, what I could think about what they maybe done. Oh, yeah, maybe they should have had a discussion with the supervisor. Maybe I would have done this. Maybe I would have done that. But then I feel like, well, I'm not really comfortable. And by the way, I don't think, if the question of law, what standard, I don't know why a judge who would be a new judge, new to the case, Judge Below retired, would be in a position to rule on it differently than us, you know, as to what, how the standard should be applied to this record. But I'm thinking, well, I could speculate. Maybe I would have, you know, talked to them. Maybe I would have discussed those prior accidents more. Maybe I would have done this. Maybe I would have done that. But is that why I'm going to say this operator, this penalty has to be vacated, and, you know, maybe a different penalty and a higher penalty? It's really, one would expect that there would be some sort of making of a record, and I just don't think they did it carefully in this case, that you have an appreciation of, yes, there's a basis of what a reasonable operator would do in this situation. That, you know, the standard really they're trying to apply is, well, any reasonable operator, given these two prior accidents and in this situation, would have done. And they haven't really filled in that blank, and I'm a little reluctant to fill it in, and I don't know why sending it back to one of our judges that they would fill it in, you know, what basis they would fill it in. So, and also, I would suggest that if they didn't propose that standard below, as Commissioner Cohen has reminded me, that, and they've just proposed it to us here on appeal, why we would say, oh, okay, now that's the right standard, we agree with it, send it back to a new judge, judge, apply this standard to this record. Why wouldn't they have weighed that argument? I mean, you're supposed to let a judge something that a judge didn't have an opportunity to consider below is often considered waived. I mean, we don't even address it. So for us to say, yeah, you know, we like that standard, we're going to take it, we're going to vacate what the judge did below, and we're going to send it back to a different judge and look at this case under that standard. Yeah. One, I have that problem procedurally. Two, you know, mentally, I was kind of going through that in my head, saying, well, the judge is going to do exactly what we would do here. He's not going to take any more evidence or anything. He's going to sort of look at the record and sort of see what they do. Commissioner Nakamura, I think, is thoroughly familiar with the record, as he has indicated in his comments here, and has looked at it, you know, from every angle, and it's, well, wait, what? Where were they failing to be on the alert? You know, even applying the standard the Secretary wants us to apply, which I'm not even sure that in the end it really, I sort of agree with Commissioner Alton. I'm not sure how that's different, but, you know, it has the high standard, reasonable operator, be on the alert for conditions. This is, liability is being imposed here because they're the production operator of the mine. And the case law is very settled that production, if there's a violation that occurs in your mind, you will be liable. But, you know, there's various factors. I mean, I think to go to Commissioner Nakamura's example, maybe it's not so much, you know, you're talking about the car. Maybe it's not so much, you know, what the driver did or didn't do, though. It's more that I'm the owner of the car. And I think if I remember tort law, I mean, as the owner of the car, I'm probably on the hook somehow, somewhere. You know, it's my car. So it wouldn't be that I went through the stop sign. I mean, you know, and it's like, well, okay, and maybe I let somebody drive the car previously who had an accident, and now, unfortunately, you know, I've let somebody drive a car that had another accident. I mean, what should I have done? You know, how negligent am I, and how at fault am I? Obviously they didn't have driver's license or something. I mean, but do I go look at their transcript from driver's ed? Do I, you know, I mean, what, there's a lot of things I could do. You know, I could sit and drive around the block with them 10 times. I could have a lecture to them. I could do this and that, you know, that I could have done in retrospect. But what was the appropriate level of activity I had to do? I mean, the secretary just really hasn't fleshed that out enough for me in this case here, and I don't think, you know, that I'm able to really look at this record and look at what the secretary's proposed and say JWR didn't meet the standard, even under what the secretary is proposing. And, you know, I agree that the, as far as the failure to include the prior incidents, again, I'm not sure how that clarifies the situation of their negligence. I mean, if it were in or out. I mean, I think everybody was aware that there were these prior incidents. How that would show, be let in for knowledge. I mean, I don't know how that helps here. The secretary acknowledged that they had a problem with contractors. Well, okay, but, and then maybe then do you just draw from that what? You know, this, again, saying, you know, I sort of run into a blank here, just the secretary really is just keep saying to us they didn't do all they could have done. And I think, you know, that in this case, they just failed to make the case that the judge's negligence finding was not supported by substantial evidence. And then the second question is, given that if I affirm the judge's finding of lack of negligence, I did also just struggle then with, still, even if you've got this large operator with history of violations, the gravity of this violation, $500, that just doesn't seem, you know, seems really, really low. I mean, I think I agree, as Commissioner Alton said, I personally probably would have applied the Mine Act's criteria, and even without the negligence factor, just wound up with a higher penalty. And I really struggle with that, but the standard, you know, is high. Like, well, but the judge, he did, as Commissioner Cohen pointed out, he did cite to the criteria. I can't say, you know, he ignored them. He applied them. He came up with 500. On what grounds do I say no? I mean, I have to find that he abused his discretion in assessing that penalty. And I just in the end concluded that I wasn't able to really draw that conclusion. So on that basis, I would end up affirming the judge. So, sorry, is there anything that we've eliminated in our discussions that you need to think about in our draft decision? I mean, it looks like we are three. A majority of three in favor of affirming the judge. So we could proceed with a majority decision to be drafted along that line. And then I think that both Commissioner Young and Commissioner Cohen would vacate and remand.
Yeah.
Is
that your position?
That's yeah. I'm certainly not saying it's negligence as a matter of law.
Okay.
And just to be clear, I would, you know, if it goes back on remand and they find there's no negligence, I would not hold that the judge abused his discretion in assessing the penalty. I mean, I would affirm the penalty, you know, if you find if the judge finds on remand, there's no negligence. I don't think that the penalty assessed was an abuse of discretion in light of the judge's conclusion. I just disagree with this conclusion and the reasoning behind it on the negligence.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. All right. So, anything at this point, Sarah, you want to clarify?
No, I don't think
so. Okay. All right. And, thank you very much. And is there any other thing that any of my colleagues wanted to
no, ma'am.
Say at this point? Okay. With that, we will go off the record. Thank you.